8 to 10 p.m. Eastern in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows what's new.
Your body's is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not. The heart's beating faster. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run. But your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting with danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
Think of me as an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
A bunch of fables.
Where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide?
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough.
5:03 Central Time. 6:03 East Coast, 4:04 Mountain, 3:03 West Coast. Good evening, Iceland. Happy Tuesday, Australia. It is 7:03 a.m.
in Beijing.
I only know that because I may have watched some of the Olympics live. And this kid goes to bed at about 8:30. So I ain't staying up too late. Welcome to the award-winning, but yet to be nominated, This, That, and the Other Heard Every Monday and Thursday on Revolution.radio. Common spelling in your favorite internet browser. Apparently, Patrick Cornelius Rabbit III is in a host review team interview with somebody. Anyway, let's say hello to some of the folks in the chat room this evening. Dude Guy, Lana Lynx, Crip, Rick, WH Devo, Walter Mauser, Gino 2017, Carmen Novak 72, Punk Rock, Rabbit, my favorite chatter, Dr. Memjing OM, Christine C, I caught your show, ma'am, earlier, right before this program on Studio B. May Street 139, blah, blah, Rudy Wally. Crow Numero 1, Comet Mona Radler, I'm sorry. Jane, Doctor Who, Dirt Engineer. How's it? Monster 383, which equals 14. The Red Pill, Jerbear, your friends are here. Good evening, sir. Batsman, Dirt, Flippy, Pack, free hugs. Please ask for permission first. Cat, Dog, Girl, Nisomania, Melina, Noreen, Valerie, the lass across the waterhole, Siri, Sunflower, hello, ma'am, Omega, the Right Reverend, Dr. Mr. Rowe, my favorite host, in the kitchen, my favorite chat name, Popsicle Toes, Ahmad, good evening, in blessing, rounding, excuse me, up the group, good evening, one in all, how have you been? Please remember, we are 100% listener supported. A couple of ways to support us. At the homepage, freedomslips.com, common spelling, freedomslips.com, one word. On the store tab, pick yourself up a t-shirt or a mug or a clock. We do have a 15% off sale going on right now. The code is on the page. Another way to support us is the donations tab. Become a Patreon. There is the donor box. Direct payment, North America only, please. We have some cryptocurrency options. Or if you want to write a check, send it. The address is at the bottom of the page. It'll make its way to Allen, Michigan. Never been, but heard. It is nice. So I hope you're all doing wonderful on this glorious Monday. Let's begin the program. Dateline, February 7th, 2022, updated 2:14 p.m. Central Time. Chicago shootings, 22 shot, 3 fatally in weekend violence, Chicago PD reports. A man was found shot to death Sunday morning in the South Loop of the near South Side. The man, 44, was found in the street in the first block of East 24th Street about 4:30 a.m. Sunday morning with two gunshot wounds to his lower extremities, Chicago police said. He was pronounced dead at the scene. The man hasn't been identified yet. Another man also shot early Saturday morning on the near west side. The 22-year-old was in the first block of South Seeley Avenue about 2:50 a.m., when he was shot multiple times. He suffered one gunshot wound to the chest and two to the right hand and self-transported to Stroger Hospital where he died. He has not yet been identified. A person was killed and another was wounded in a shooting Saturday afternoon in Bronzeville. A male whose age wasn't known was a passenger in a vehicle that was traveling in the first block of East 43rd Street when someone fired shots about 4:35 p.m. Well, that's almost dinner time. During the shooting, the vehicle struck two others in traffic before coming to a stop. The male was found inside with a gunshot wound to the side and was pronounced dead at the scene. His name hasn't been released. A 21-year-old man was also wounded at the scene. He was shot in the arm and torso and self-transported to the University of Chicago Medical Center. His condition wasn't known. It wasn't clear if both males were traveling in the vehicle. Two guns were found at the scene, according to police. And if you wish to read some more of these happy times in Chicago, there's the link in the chat room. I just, you know, last week in 18 were shot, 4 fatally. So, happy times, happy times, happy times. That's all I got to say. Happy times, happy times, happy times. Unbelievable, kids. Unbelievable. It is what it is. It is what it is. Here we go.
David Paulides wrote the books on Missing 411, in which he exposes a cover-up by the largest body of federally trained police officers in the United States, the Forest Rangers of the National Park Service. They're covering up abnormally high numbers of disappearances in our national parks. Thousands of people go missing every year under circumstances that defy logic.
Oh, wait. Sorry, I read that case already. 28-year-old hiker Rachel Lackaduke was found, and evidence shows she most likely succumbed to environmental exposure. A few days after that, another missing female hiker was found, her name Tatum Morrell. Now, the Can-Am account, YouTube content creator David Paulides, has covered Tatum Morrell's case. In his video, DP focuses on granite and water. Again, what I like to do is we hear directly from Paulides. So let's do that. Regarding the presumed mysterious death of Tatum Morrell, according to David Paulides.
And when you look at this area on Google Maps,
FYI, just fast forward.
What is stunning is that there's no ground cover. There's no place to hide.
Sorry.
Google Maps.
Hang on.
Summit, where it was at 10 minutes. It radiates that strong.
Hang on. Where is it?
But they flew at night. They didn't find
it. Here it is.
They bring in canines to her campsite, and they couldn't pick up a scent that would track out. She was wearing a red-colored jacket and was carrying a blue-colored backpack. All of this area, including her campsite, was at 10,000 feet and higher. All of the peaks she wanted to summit were at 12,000 feet thereabouts or higher. And when you look at this area on Google Maps, what is stunning is that there's no ground cover. There's no place to hide. Yeah. So, this is Tatum. In shape girl, super smart, high intellect, loved the outdoors, was no rookie to this, carried a personal transponder, knew the risks. Troubling, troubling, troubling. Now, when I first heard about the case, the area was ringing a bell, and as soon as I got home, I went to my Montana map, and son of a gun, she disappeared right in the middle of a cluster zone, right near the Wyoming border. If you have the Montana book and you have the map that came with the book, you're going to see there's this cluster zone right there. And right away, my heart started pounding because I thought, oh, boy, that's horrific.
Yeah, so that's enough of listening to Paulides. So let's deconstruct this case. Again, two things were mentioned. Quote, I'm going to hammer this into you. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of small bodies of water. Hundreds of small bodies of water. Why is that important? Because when I see this on a map, I can already tell you there is probably going to be a cluster nearby. Why is that? Because this is nothing but granite and water. I really pray that Tatum's parents are doing good, and I know they are not doing good. But what? Paulides also goes on to discuss her German origin, her high intellect, goes on to further state that she's an in-shape girl, super smart, high intellect, loved the outdoors, was no rookie to this, carried a personal transponder, knew the risks, et cetera, et cetera. You heard the rest. So what really happened? The Morrell family and Red Lodge Fire Rescue personnel met with the recovery teams at the Red Lodge Airport. This is reported from KMVT, Channel 11 News. For those interested, I am posting for you the link in the chat room. Officials say two Bear Air and the Yellowstone County Sheriff helicopter worked together with Red Lodge Fire Rescue and Carbon County Sheriff's Office to recover her body from below the Whitetail Couloir. Rescuers believe that Morrell was climbing Whitetail Peak when she was, quote, caught in a significant rock slide and died. She was difficult to find, since she was buried under rocks. After almost 2 months of extensive search efforts, we are relieved that she is able to be returned to her family, said Assistant Chief John Trapp of Red Lodge Fire Rescue. The effort volunteers putting into finding Tatum surpassed anything I've seen in my 17 years with search and rescue operations. It was absolutely incredible. Morrell was an avid and experienced hiker who planned to climb five mountain peaks over 12,000 feet in the West Fork of Rock Creek near Red Lodge. So the questions we have, how reliable is the missing 411 framework when a female hiker who dies in a rock slide is labeled missing 411? Should Paulides apologize for using Tatum Morrell as missing 411 fodder? Probably not. I mean, whether you understand this or not, granite is the most common rock on land. Why, basalt is the most common in the ocean floor. It's so common that you can't choose it as a criteria for unexplained disappearances. It's almost like choosing oxygen. You know, all these people disappear in the presence of oxygen. Oh, no. Perhaps it means aliens or Bigfoot. Also, it's safe to presume that hikers are going to cluster around water. I don't know, the state of New England. Sorry, the New England area, I'm sorry, gets lots of water. The water's heavy. So hikers, I'm guessing, prefer to stick to the side of the river or hike from water source to water source. My guess is that in desert regions, it would even be more pronounced. But, you know, I haven't hiked across a desert, so I don't know. I'm just guessing. My point is this. Hikers and backpackers gather around water. Disappearances will cluster around water. It's a given. I mean, look, anytime I see a rock slide, I'm looking for a body. Anytime I see a rock slide, I'm looking for a body. The mystery of Robert Springfield's remains. A mystery that remains, perhaps. Robert Springfield was a hunter who went missing in 2004, and some of his remains were found 1 year later in 2005. Springfield was a Native American with a local, and the local coroner was, quote, not permitted to examine the remains, according to the Billings Gazette, dated October 31st, 2007. Tribal and federal law enforcement prevented him from going to the site where the remains were found. Robert Springfield's sister, Maya Gross Venture, is quoted as saying, on the morning he disappeared, gunshots were heard on the mountain. The article states Springfield did not have a gun, just a bow. The article continues, she said a law enforcement officer who came to talk to the family the day the remains were removed from the mountain said Springfield may have been shot and that there was a hole in the back of his leather vest. It took the FBI 2 years to process the remains, and researcher Paulides thinks the reason they found something big and that there's a cover-up. Missing fact number one. In an interview with Where Did the Road Go? 2016, Paulides and the host talk about the Robert Springfield case. Again, I like to provide sources. Here we go.
First one we can look at is Robert Springfield.
Well, Robert was a Native American, and he was hunting on the Crow Indian Reservation, kind of located in the southeast section of Montana, Bighorn Mountains. This incident happened in September 19th, 2004. He's 49 years old. And this area is known for big game, big mountains. Well, he was with his son, Colton, age 13, and his adopted son, Brent. And they went into an area called Black Canyon for elk hunting. And Robert was a bow hunter, and he was armed. And he couldn't move real good because he had a disability from work. So he was going to stand in one area of the canyon as the kids kind of herded the elk down towards him. Well, as this was going on, and they got later in the afternoon, the kids started to arrive back at a prearranged spot, and Robert didn't come back. And again, this is an area of the reservation where you have to have special privileges to go into, and the public obviously would never go in there. But when he disappeared, the tribal police took over along with the Bighorn County Sheriff. And right away, they got a helicopter with FLIR making low-flying reconnaissance missions over the area, saw nothing. And the SAR search and rescue went on for days, and then his family and friends took it over for more days. Nobody ever found anything. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the sheriff also brought in canines and equestrians, found nothing. In October 2005, about 13 months after the incident happened, the disappearance, a hunter was in that Black Canyon area, and say 150 feet away, he hears a crow screeching its head off, just like bellowing. And it was incessant. And so the hunter started to walk towards the tree where this bird was at, and it never stopped, just screaming and yelling. And he walked to the bottom of the tree, and he saw human remains. Well, the hunter led authorities to the tree, where they found a partial skull, a femur, and a neatly rolled up men's belt next to the skull. Two boots sat neatly stacked right next to the skull and the femur. And there was a man's coat on the ground with a small tear in the back. And a wallet was found with money in it, indicating it was Robert's. The only items missing from the scene were his bow and arrows. Well, the sheriff, in his infinite wisdom, decided this is very suspicious, and he called the FBI out to work the scene. So, because this is federal land, because it's an Indian reservation, the FBI has primary authority. Well, they came and they worked it, and they sent the remains to the ID section at Quantico, Virginia. Well, his wife, in the months following, was giving conflicting information as to the cause of death. She was first told he was shot. She was later told he was killed by a falling tree. Well, the scene where he was found was just above where this master search and rescue operations center was at. It was close to it. And so there's no way she didn't believe that the body parts were there during the search, because she believed they would have found them. And it says this in all the reports. Now, 2 years after the FBI took custody of the body parts, they still had them, which is weird. And they stated that they were categorizing him in DNA for input into their system. Well, finally, on March 3rd, 2009, almost 5 years after, or 4 years after they found his body, the family had to file a federal lawsuit to get the body parts back. And the lawsuit stated that Robert died under suspicious circumstances and the FBI failed to investigate the incident. Now, they eventually did get the body parts back, but the oddities behind this, you got to think about this clearly. The screeching crow is almost like a beacon. Hey, come here. There's something here.
Yeah.
If someone came across the body and the remains and stole the bow, why not steal the money in the wallet?
Yeah.
And then why would the FBI keep the remains for 2 years and force the family to go to litigation to get it back? To me, that's unbelievable.
Is it believable or unbelievable? Well, let's find out. So, what is the reason the FBI kept the remains for 2 years? Well, my fine feathered friends, Congress had passed a law that required the FBI lab to create a DNA database. This caused long delays, and a lack of funding created a huge backlog since thousands of cases had to be processed. That, according to the Billing Gazette, dated October 31st, 2007, quote, Trent Peterson, an FBI supervisory agent, in Salt Lake City, who has been working with local agents on getting Springfield's remains back to the family, said Wednesday that approval has finally been granted to release the remains. He said he couldn't give an exact date when they would be turned over to Bighorn County Coroner Terry Bullis, because paperwork has to be completed before their release and transportation arrangements must be made. The long delay was the result of a recent act of Congress establishing a DNA database for all remains received at the lab, Peterson said. But the legislation did not include enough funding to get it done quickly, resulting you know, in a backlog. Hundreds of thousands of cases have to be processed, he said. We've been working diligently to do that. DNA processing is not a quick process by any means, end quote. Now, in that whole summary of the case, David Politis does not mention the law. And the reason he does not mention the law is because it would have answered the question, why would the FBI keep the remains for 2 years and force the family to go to litigation to get it back? To me, that's unbelievable. This is factual research by David Politis, kids. And this is the B as in B, S as in S, S as in S stuff that he does. Let's continue.
And then
it seems like more trouble than it would have been worth for them.
Yeah. Or what was there that there must have been something big that they were still looking for in those remains that they couldn't figure out, and they were willing to go to litigation to just give them the time to figure it out.
Oh, that's interesting. The host then points out quickly that a couple of bones were found. Let's deconstruct this fact by Politis. Politis makes the following points. The FBI found, quote, something big they could not figure out. Point two, the FBI needed more time. These two assertions by Politis are not supported by any evidence. We already know the new law affected thousands of cases. No, does Politis imply that something big happened in all the other cases as well? Were they all killed by the missing 411 phenomenon? The transdimensional portal alien hybrid Bigfoot that comes through and kidnaps people? It should be noted that the term something big is never defined by Politis, nor does the host ask him. So what that means is anybody's guess. The Billings Gazette dated October 31st, 2007 also states, quote, Peterson said that despite what family members may think, the FBI has been working diligently trying to get special approval so Springfield's remains can be returned to the family. But when Congress passes a law, we have to comply. Again, it appears government regulations caused the delay in the processing of Robert Springfield's remains, not the mysterious missing 411 monster. Once again, folks, we have deconstructed the exciting factual information presented by David Politis. B as in B, S as in S. Let's head over to bedtime stories for a break for this week's edition. Sit back and enjoy.
In previous episodes, we have examined reported incidents involving cryptids in possession of near supernatural abilities, as well as others focusing on allegations of ghostly and inexplicable poltergeist activity. But this week, we'll be looking at a mysterious series of events which incorporate both. Join us as we delve into the horrifying history of the Hexham Heads. Pushing open the low wooden gate which led into her front garden, the schoolgirl shouted a farewell to her two friends, who had continued on their way along Rose Road. Aware that her parents would both still be at work for another hour or two, she bent down to retrieve the front door key from its hiding place beneath the flower pot, and then let herself inside. As she did every evening as she returned home from school, Bernice Ross hung her school blazer and bag on her allocated peg, and then looked around for the family cat. The ginger Tom was less than a year old, highly inquisitive, and was always waiting for her in the hallway upon her return. And yet today, the room stood dark and silent, with no trace of the family pet. Calling out its name, Bernice paused for a moment before she heard a muffled cry coming from inside the front room. Joyfully, the girl strode across the hall and pushed the door open to find the small cat sitting staring back at her. Reaching out to pick it up, she was startled when it suddenly lashed out at her with its claws, hissing angrily. Staring down in disbelief at her pet, which had never acted this way before, she slowly backed away out into the hall. Bernice was halfway to the door when she heard a muffled thud from up on the landing. Aware she should be alone in the house, the 15-year-old called out for her parents, receiving nothing but silence in return. Peering up into the dark shadows which blotted out the top of the staircase, Bernice convinced herself that she must have been hearing things, and had turned her attention back to the cat when she heard yet another soft thud emanate from above her. Almost immediately, the small animal gave a frightened mewl before retreating further into the living room. Bernice began to edge towards the front door, her eyes fixed on the top of the staircase. Ever so slowly, a foot appeared from the shadow, carefully and deliberately planting itself on the uppermost step. It rested there for a moment, before another appeared, descending to the next step down. They were like no feet she had ever seen, covered in a thick pelt of fur with menacing claws extending out from long toes. They began to continue their journey down the stairs towards her. Step by step, a nightmarish apparition revealed itself, its whole body covered in the same dark hair. She could see now that its face was dominated by a long snout, with a wide mouth filled with sharp teeth. As the intruder fixed her with a searching stare, its mouth opened even further, a thick tongue lolling to one side. The girl let out an ear-piercing scream, as long and as loud as she could. Instantaneously, the terrifying creature recoiled, bolting up and over the banister above it, and disappearing from sight. Hours later, when Richard Feacham arrived home from work, he found his daughter shut in the living room. The door was barricaded, and she had her beloved cat cradled in her arms, still too terrified to go anywhere else in their home. The incident was the last straw for Richard, who immediately phoned the university where his wife was working. In blunt terms, he delivered his ultimatum. Either she removed the antiquities she was researching from inside their home, or he would take the children and leave. The bewildering story of the two mysterious items that would later become known as the Hexham Heads began in May of 1971 in the rear garden of 3 Reed Avenue, an anonymous dwelling situated in the Northumbrian market town of Hexham. This was the home of the Robson family, and on the afternoon in question, the family's two sons were playing outside the house in the rear garden. Colin and Leslie Robson had been engaged in a game which consisted of digging small pebbles up out of the ground and then throwing them at one another. They had been occupied by this activity for a short while, much to the frustration of their mother, when both boys suddenly ceased what they were doing. When Mrs. Robson stepped outside to check on them, her two sons produced a pair of unnaturally smooth stones, both of which appeared to have crude human faces etched upon them. They were roughly 6 centimeters in diameter, but quite different in their apparent design. One was quite masculine in appearance, seeming to represent a young boy, whilst the other possessed distinctly female features. Suitably impressed with their find, the two boys brought the stones back into the house and set them to one side. But over the course of the coming days, they would come to regret this decision. The first indication that something unnatural may have entered the house along with the two artifacts came when the adults of the family noticed that the stones seemed to be able to move of their own accord. Waking up of a morning, Mr. and Mrs. Robson would find that the heads had been turned around overnight, facing the opposite direction to how they had been left the previous evening. Sometimes they were found lying on the floor, and on several occasions they were located in different rooms to the one they had been left in. Not long after this, there were several instances of glass objects inexplicably shattering inside the house, despite there having been no one near them at the time of their destruction. Although all the broken glass was collected and disposed of, long shards were later found secreted under the pillows of the girls of the household, a transgression which both boys vehemently denied they had anything to do with. Then, after several weeks of this strange activity, Colin woke up crying in the middle of the night. When Mrs. Robson went to comfort him, he claimed that he'd felt his hair being yanked whilst he was sleeping by a pair of invisible hands. Colin's mother had been sitting on his bed, trying to soothe both him and his brother, who had been awoken by the commotion, when she had suddenly become aware of a presence in the doorway. Looking up, she was horrified to see a haunting vision staring back at her from the entrance to the room. It was humanoid in appearance, but was entirely covered in fur, with a face resembling that of a goat or sheep. The second this entity became aware that Mrs. Robson could see it, it immediately disappeared from sight, leaving no trace it had ever been there. Trying to write the incident off as being emotional and overtired, the rattled housewife elected not to mention the encounter to anyone else. But she was horrified shortly afterwards, when her neighbours revealed a similar sighting. Number 1 Reed Avenue was located directly next door to the Robson family residence, and was home to Isaac and Nellie Dodd, who had 4 children of their own. Whilst having a drink one evening with her neighbour, Nellie asked if the Robsons had experienced anything unusual in the weeks before. When asked why, she recounted an unnerving situation which had played out several nights before. On the evening in question, young Marie Dodd had been suffering the effects of a severe ear infection, and so Nellie had gone into the youngster's room at bedtime in order to comfort her. Just as Marie was on the verge of dropping off to sleep, the girl had suddenly sat upright in her bed and began to scream uncontrollably. Unable to calm her daughter down, Nellie had pleaded with her to reveal what was wrong, and was horrified when she slowly raised a finger and pointed to something behind her. The mother turned to see a terrifying creature standing at her shoulder, apparently reaching out for her with a long taloned hand. The intruder had the body of a man, but a face composed of several different animals, like a combination of features possessed by a wolf and a goat. Almost immediately, Nellie also started to scream, her frantic cries merging with those of her daughters. The two women watched in horror as the creature dropped down onto all fours, and then quickly fled the room. As Isaac Dodd came running across the landing towards the bedroom, he stopped in his tracks as he heard heavy footsteps proceeding down the staircase behind him. Running back to the top of the stairs, he heard the back door to the address opening. As he quickly made his way down into the hallway, He found the door now wide open. Isaac had locked the door himself an hour before, and was at a loss to explain how it had been opened. More bewildering still, there was no trace of anyone in the garden, despite the high fences surrounding it, and the side gate still secured with a deadbolt. In the days that followed the encounter, activity similar to that experienced in the Robson household began to manifest at Number 1. Several bottles were seen to roll off tables and smash onto the floor, despite being upright and unattended at the time. The children also made repeated claims that they had been slapped or had their hair tugged by an invisible hand. Eventually, the activity became so distressing that the Dodds considered moving away from the area, but as events were about to demonstrate, whatever had plagued them was far from tethered to the town of Hexham. After several weeks of apparent poltergeist attacks, the Robsons finally decided that enough was enough, and passed the heads on to staff at the local abbey. From there, the trinkets were sent to Southampton University for analysis, arriving on the desk of a lecturer named Anne Ross. Dr. Ross was an expert in the field of pagan antiquity, and formed the opinion that the two small stone carvings were likely Celtic in origin. During the course of her analysis, she eventually took them home, placing them in a box, but then subsequently forgot about them. A week later, Dr. Ross awoke unexpectedly one evening after feeling a presence in her bedroom. Straining her eyes and looking into the dark corners of the room as her husband slept beside her, she suddenly caught sight of a dark shape, standing concealed in the shadows. As the figure then hurried towards the door, she caught a brief glimpse of a tall and slender frame. It moved upright as a biped, covered in jet-black fur, with a wolf-like snout protruding from its face. Jumping out of the bed in pursuit, the doctor saw it disappear down her stairs, but was too frightened to follow. Initially, she did not associate the event with the Hexham Heads, but several days later, there was a further encounter. Her husband Richard was ill in bed, and their 15-year-old daughter had been taking him a meal upstairs when she had found her path blocked by a sinister entity. As Bernice had tried to scream, the intruder had vaulted the banister and disappeared from sight. The young girl had clearly heard the thump of its feet hitting the wooden flooring of the hall below, but when she ventured a look down, there was no trace of it. When nothing of a similar nature took place over the next week, the professor believed the matter concluded, only to receive an angry phone call from her husband while she was at work. He returned home to find that Bernice had locked herself in the living room and was too terrified to come out. When she had calmed down, she told him she had seen the creature as she had come home from school. Having now become aware of the history behind the items she was keeping, the doctor hastily removed them and had them placed into storage at the university. The heads would stay there for the next 7 years, subjected to occasional testing, until they were then acquired by a man named Frank Hyde. He was an engineer with an interest in the paranormal, and asked to be allowed to run tests on them using a Faraday cage. When Hyde passed on in 1984, the location of the heads was lost with him, and whilst the result of his tests on the items have never been made public, some of those conducted at the university were indeed published. The studies carried out by the staff at Southampton University have only added further mystery to the origins of the Hexham Heads. They were so roughly carved that it proved difficult to find techniques from any previous historical period to align them to. In addition, there was no organic matter held within the stones, making them virtually impossible to date. it was ascertained that they had been created from what appeared to be solid rock, rather than from any modern composite or type of cement, and that the rock used was grey sandstone, possessing a high degree of quartz. This was in keeping with the rock formations found in the area immediately surrounding Hexham. There was, however, no evidence that the Celts had ever settled the region, and the stones were unlike anything found in the culture of the Roman settlers who founded the town. In 1974, a local tradesman named Des Craigie came forward to claim that he had carved the stones for his daughter, having resided at 3 Reed Avenue before the Robsons moved in. To prove the point, he produced a number of copies carved from a composite material, moulded from local crushed stone. But whilst these were similar in nature, Craigie's claims were dismissed by academics, who stated that the carvings and materials used were different. So, if the Hexham heads were not a prank or oddity produced by a local resident, then what were they? In the absence of any further evidence, it would seem that the parallels drawn by Dr. Ross may be the closest explanation. The Celts believed that the head was the location of the human soul, and that stone depictions of it may create links to the spirit world. Countless crude representations of stone heads have been unearthed around Britain, often situated near water, which was believed to act as a conduit for the undead. Hexham is also no stranger to stories involving wolf-like creatures, and in 1904, both the town and the neighbouring settlement of Allendale were plagued by a series of brutal cattle slayings. Veterinarians who examined the bodies claim that the culprit was most likely a large wolf, and several such predators were hunted and killed during the following months. But the slayings continued for another year, until suddenly coming to an end, for no apparent reason. When later interviewed in relation to the Hexham heads, Dr. Ross stated she had never heard the story of the Wolf of Allendale. Given the great distance between Southampton and Northumbria, and the relatively localized nature of the legend, this seems entirely feasible. In the years which have passed since the mid-1970s, the families involved in the story have maintained their accounts of the incidents, without deviation. What little interest there was from the press at the time has long faded, and perhaps the only way to resurrect the story would be to admit that it was a hoax, but both the Ross and Dodd children still stand by their claims. With the loss of the stones, we will likely never know the link between their creation and the bizarre humanoid entities which were seemingly attached to them. All we can do is wait and see if any similar antiquities come to light in the future, and if they do so, what else surfaces alongside them?
Thank you to our friends over at Bedtime Stories. Oh, hang on a second. Wait. I made some hot cocoa and I forgot it over on the table because, as you may know, I have two cats. And I feel bad for them when they knock their little toys and balls underneath the couch. So then I moved the couch because, you know, they got me wrapped around their little paws. Then I throw the yellow balls in the favorite box they'd like to hang out in. And it lasts for about a week, and then they end up knocking them out, and then, you know, knock them under furniture again. So, as you may or may not know, I was going to build this year. It took me almost a year to figure out the plan I wanted. And I was with the builder today, looking at materials and picking out doorknobs and these sorts of things, and I just thought, you know, I got a bad feeling. I don't necessarily mind paying the increased price
What I am concerned about is supply chains and whether or not the fact that if I would order windows Wednesday, it would take 13 weeks for the windows to arrive. 3 months. Well, normally you can build a house in around 3 to 4 months. And I found out that a customer had ordered some windows, but the interior color on the windows they wanted had been delayed an additional 12 or 13 weeks, so they're just going to wait. And the color that I originally wanted, delivery time 29 weeks. And my thought is, look, again, I don't necessarily mind paying the price, except I'd like to be in control of a number of things. And at least with building a house, you got a window of about 3 to 4 months, as long as you order things. But the fact that it's taking months to order things doesn't make me feel good. So I'm just going to put it off, build a garage. That's easy enough, right? Yeah. Build a garage. Do it on the weekends. Give me something to do. So, plus, the garage I have designed is technically called a little cabin garage. It's a garage with a workbench area, a workshop, which may or may not easily convert into a little studio apartment, little studio room. Just saying. Looks like a garage from the outside. You can use it as a cabin. You just don't homestead it. You just get mail delivered there. So there you go. All right, what do we got going on next hour? Excuse me. I have no idea. I think it'll be the ghosts of Kadena Air Base. Unfortunately, we do not have any, excuse me, new or updated BFRO updates, which is quite sad. We could take a trip down the road of the Chupacabra. I think we'll do that next hour. Take a trip down the road of the infamous Chupacabra, I believe. You know, dig in a little bit to cryptozoologist Lorene Coleman and Patrick Hughey. I think that's what we'll do. Talk about Madeline Talentino. See, that's why it's too bad they weren't able to take Art Bell's consciousness and put it into a robot. That way we could still have Coast to Coast AM programs. I don't know. Do we want to talk about the Chupacabra next hour? I don't know. I don't know. It's all just a big mess. It's all a big mess. I feel like I'm missing something. Has Russia invaded Ukraine yet? That's a big deal. do we have, apparently, according to some people, Ukraine? Nope, nothing's happening. Every news channel in the U.S. Yep, it's happening. What's actually sad is somebody wrote this in the host chat, which I hadn't noticed because I do not watch local TV. Local news or even cable type news. But somebody made a comment regarding that even Fox News isn't covering the caravan, which says everything you need to say, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I don't feel bad that I don't, I don't feel bad that I don't keep up on things. I really don't. But that's just me. If you care about the medal count so far, Sweden the most golds with 3. Russia Olympic Committee, a total of seven medals, two gold, three silver, two bronze. Netherlands, two gold. The United States, 14th with three silver medals. Three silver medals, kiddies. That's all they got. And if you're really interested, the big hockey matchup tonight, it's the United States women's hockey team versus those evil folks from the north, otherwise known as Canada, airs at 10:45 p.m. Eastern Time, or 9:45 Central Time, which is technically, 1:45 a.m. over in Beijing. All right, folks, you are tuned into This, That, and the Other here on Revolution.radio, common spelling in your favorite internet browser, or Freedom's Lips, one word, .com. Head on over to the website. We are 100% listener supported. A number of ways to support us. You can donate. We have some donation options there. You can also write us a check. Another way is the store tab. Purchase yourself a mug or a t-shirt, perhaps one of both. Another way, which is completely free, is join us in chat. Or take a look at our schedule, Studios A and B. You'll see a number of open slots. If you feel you have the gift for gab, hit the contact tab, send a Mad and Lady Horse an email, and you may have a meeting via Skype with the review host team. Host review team. Host team review. Host review and team, I believe, is all part of it. I don't know the exact way in which it's mentioned. I'm waiting for Pat to yell at me in chat because he has to correct me every time. Here comes the top of the hour of music, folks. I'll speak with you shortly.
If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays for Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
The pill has been taken. Blinders are off. Are we in the endgame? Or are we simply living a replay of a time that's already happened, with no choices? Different people have different points of view. When it comes to creation versus evolution, my point of view, we were created to evolve. The Red Pill, every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern in Studio B. www.freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. Check it out.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
A little honey on the lone highway, left me for another on the lone highway. They killed dirty Don McGee on the lone highway.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution, Revolution. Radio! The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Seven times you've gone from frugal to cheap. Thank you, CNBC. You've carefully saved some money. I'm sorry, you've carefully saved some of your income for an emergency. Fantastic. You're making out your employer's match to 401k. Be proud. Your friends no longer invite you out to dinner because you always insist on splitting the entree. It might be time to rethink your priorities. Once you cross the line from frugal to ultra cheap, your habits may cost you more than friendships. In your pursuit to save money, you could actually pay a price. Here are seven signs you've left frugal finances behind and are entering extreme tightwad territory. This should be interesting. You skip or scrimp on important events because of the cost. We're not talking about saying no to a destination wedding for your second cousin twice removed. We're talking about skipping a coworker's wedding because you can't bring yourself to buy a $5 card and slip a $20 bill inside. Or maybe your daughter had her heart set on an Italian restaurant for her birthday dinner, but you insist on Mexican because you've got a coupon. You turn down events and use money as an excuse, it may be time to check yourself before you wreck yourself. I just added that. Saving money is nice, but personal relationships are more valuable than an extra $20 in an already plump bank account. You insult your friends' spending habits. If you find yourself telling friends how you would never spend so much on something they just bought, that's a red flag. The same goes for comments couched as advice on how your friends could save money. Being a super saver isn't a problem until you think it gives you license to judge other people's spending habits and priorities. Well, I'm going to disagree. You're free to insult your friends' spending habits if you hear them always complaining about not having any money. Most often, for the friends that just frivolously spend their money, they don't have much. They're living paycheck to paycheck. But hey, If you want to hit the fast food joint every day for the dollar menu, you know, so be it. Just don't ask me for a loan. Actually, it'd be charity in that case, I think. Three, you drive across town to save a buck. Well, that's just dumb because you're going to spend more money on gas getting there. That's my prediction. There's nothing wrong with trying to cut costs on everyday purchases, but when the savings, where's the savings when you drive 20 minutes for gas that's 10 cents a gallon cheaper? Although shopping at five different stores may get you the best deals, is the money you save worth losing a day of your life each week or the gas it costs? Number four, your days revolve around saving money. How many hours do you devote to saving money? Do you wake up and hit the Facebook sales sites before clipping coupons and reworking your budget every morning? There's no reason to feel bad about shopping for bargains and staying on top of your finances. However, when saving money becomes an obsession, it's time to step back. Be money smart, but don't let dollars dictate yourself. Do you think there's a so-called thing called sex addiction. I wonder if there's a thing called cheap addiction. Five, you do things that are dishonest or unethical to save a few dollars. It doesn't hurt anyone if you borrow the neighbor's Wi-Fi, right? Doing things that are dishonest or unethical to save money doesn't make those things any less dishonest or unethical. Well, that depends on who you're asking. In other words, if you can't afford the tip, don't go out to dinner. No, if you have shitty service at a restaurant, you don't tip. You are constantly replacing broken items. Cheap jeans aren't a bargain if the seams come undone by the third wash. The same can be said for cheap toys, cheap sheets, cheap appliances, and cheap dates. I'm kidding. You don't come out ahead if you have to regularly replace or repair items. Buying better quality goods saves money in the long run. Yes, you don't want to move into a new place and then go buy the cheap off-the-rack bath towels and washcloths, because after a few washes, they're going to start to disintegrate. If you can afford it, spend a little more money at the beginning. You break your budget to save. Here's the most insidious part of saving money. It can actually make you spend more. Retailers know this, and that's why they send out emails offering free shipping or a percentage off your purchase if you buy a certain amount. Then you end up spending $100 when you plan for $75. If your budget doesn't add up, that savings could be to blame. For many people, saving money is a thrill and something of a game. However, taken too far, cutting costs could have a negative impact on your relationship and your bottom line. Yeah. There you go. The Chupacabra earned its name only as recently as 1995. Widely publicized news reports of cattle mutilations in two small Puerto Rican towns. The reports were fairly conventional, following the same pattern of most cattle mutilations in the news. This happens every so often all around the world. Suffice it to say, the animal dies for whatever reason, and then very quickly, perhaps a matter of hours, certain birds and or insects will attack its exposed soft tissues, eyes, mouth, genitals. As the animal is dead, there is zero blood pressure and thus no blood, making it seem like the animal has been drained of blood. The dead skin pulls tight from the excised area, giving the impression of surgical cut lines. All these things happened following the incidents in Puerto Rico back in 1995. Police sought the satanic cults. Ufologists looked for the aliens, and comedians leveraged the colorful events for new material. One of these, radio personality Silvio Perez, is generally believed to be the first to put the Spanish words for suck and goat together and called it the Chupacabra. Some credit others with coming up with the name first, and some researchers have found one or two earlier appearances of the compound word in the world's literature, But 1995 in Puerto Rico was the first time the world was used as the name of a vampirical livestock killing monster known affectionately as the Chupacabra. For some 5 months, the Chupacabra was really only known in Puerto Rico, and then only really in the domain of ufologists, vampire believers, and other fringe theorists. A few initial cattle mutilations had been the extent of the phenomenon, and it likely would have died out like all the world's other countless cattle mutilation cases. But then came the event that made the Chupacabra immortal. Madeline Tolentino lived with her mother in a small municipality on the east end of Puerto Rico's biggest city, San Juan, and some 54 kilometers east of where the cattle mutilations had taken place. Her mother woke her from a nap one afternoon and took her to the front window where a strange creature was hopping about in the yard. It was some 3 feet tall, usually misreported as 4 to 5 feet tall, with wrinkly gray skin like wet leather with short fur. Its arms and legs were thin and each had 3 very long digits. Its face was flat with slanted wraparound eyes. It hopped like a kangaroo. Most notably, it had a line of long, thin spikes running down its back. Tolentino was persuaded it was the Chupacabra, and the story was reported. A sketch was made and widely circulated. The story was all over the news. The mayor vowed to protect the public from the menace. Tolentino's basic description has informed much of Chupacabra lore ever since. And while many Chupacabra reports have followed the model, many more have not. Most Chupacabras sighted in the last years, especially in the U.S., were more like canines and have been adequately explained as dogs, coyotes, or foxes with mangy, explaining their strange, hairless, emaciated appearance. Others point to vampire stories from throughout the Americas as evidence that the Chupacabra predates the Puerto Rico cattle mutilations, such as the Mocha vampire from 1975 in Puerto Rico, a giant winged and feathered creature, or the Nicaragua beast of 2000, shot by a rancher who caught it attacking his goats, and it turned out to be an ordinary dog. There are countless such stories from the Americas since 1995, all attributed to the Chupacabra. Every one that has been identified has turned out to be a dog, a coyote, a raccoon, or in a particularly head-scratching case, the odd-looking carcass of a skate, a type of ray from the ocean. Why have all these obviously unrelated incidents been called Chupacabra events? The answer is what cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman and Patrick Heige called the lumping problem. This, if you don't know, is when people throw a single name at what may be unrelated creatures or phenomena. To use their example, they express frustration when people attach the name Bigfoot to reports of creatures from all around the world that may have different colors, behaviors, sizes, creatures that they believe may be zoologically distinct and deserving of individualized investigation. But you don't have to be a cryptozoologist to recognize the difficulties that the lumping problem introduces. Now, the lumping problem can be responsible for people taking many different irreconcilable phenomena and calling them all ball lightning, or many unrelated phenomena in the sky during earthquakes and calling them all earthquake lights. When Madeline Tolentino saw her spiky alien creature, why was it blamed for the cattle mutilations on other parts of the island? Konavanyas is nowhere near the two towns where the cattle mutilations are reported. The one thing had absolutely nothing to do with the other. Tolentino reported that her creature was basically just hopping around in her mother's yard in an urban residential neighborhood. It wasn't attacking any animals, drinking anyone's blood, or behaving in any threatening way at all. What evidence linked the creature to the livestock deaths? You know, if you hear that a jewelry store was robbed in another city, and then 5 months later you happen to see an unusual-looking person on the street in your own town, you don't instantly charge that person with the robbery. Well, maybe you do. Maybe you're a profiler. And there is no evidence linking one thing to the other. We have nothing to investigate. But we can still present a confident theory. Our brains do this all the time. A brain's whole job is to link things together, to recognize things, to match one thing to another. When we hear a strange thing was done by an unknown agent, and then we see a very strange agent, boom, our brain makes the connection. Even though there were countless thousands of human beings close to the mutilated cattle, all of whom are far more physically capable of harming livestock than Tolentino's small, thin creature would be, the creature was strange, and the mutilations were strange. And that's all it takes for our brains, automatic pattern matching, to render a verdict strange. However, in this particular case, we have two reasons to go further than merely exonerating the creature from any blood-sucking activities. First, as already discussed, it is virtually certain that there was no attacking entity involved in the cattle deaths. We have no crime with which to charge Tolentino's creature. And second, we have sufficient reason to dismiss Tolentino's account completely. This became public in 2011 with the publication of Tracking the Chupacabra by Benjamin Ratford in the Squaring the Strange podcast. Tracking the Chupacabra was the first scholarly book purely dedicated to an exhaustive investigation of the entire Chupacabra phenomenon, the vampire phenomenon as a whole, the many sightings and reports of chupacabras from around the world, and importantly, a deep dive into the most story points. The most astounding of Radford's many discoveries was that Madeline Tolentino had, perhaps unintentionally, already thoroughly debunked her own story in a 1996 interview for UFO Digest. A couple of weeks before Tolentino's alleged sighting of the creature in her mother's yard, the movie Species was released in San Juan. It's about a creature which matches the description of Tolentino's chupacabra right down to the spikes. Created in a Puerto Rican laboratory by government scientists using alien DNA, which escapes and goes around killing people, Tolentino told them what she'd seen in the movie and that an unnamed journalist told her those alien hybrid creatures who escaped from the government lab lived in nearby El Yunque National Forest. The interview makes it apparent that Tolentino knew the movie was just a movie, but that she also believed its setting was completely real. That a government laboratory in Puerto Rico creates alien hybrid creatures, which can sometimes escape. Following his own interview with Tolentino, Radford wrote, and I quote, "It would be like an American audience in 2008 watching the film The Hurt Locker about a bomb disposal expert in the Iraq War. Though the movie is clearly fictional, it is set in a real place and has elements of real life. Tolentino believed what she saw in the film was actually happening in real life." Again, this all came directly from Tolentino herself. She saw a species, believed it was a fact that alien hybrid creatures like the one in the film were running around loose in her area. It should be little wonder that her personal description of such a creature matched the one in the movie, feature for feature. But even beyond that, we have good reason to doubt that she ever had any such sighting at all. She told Radford that she encountered it on a second occasion in December of 1995, which seems highly dubious, and her husband, Miguel Agosto, interrupted the UFO Digest interview to assert that he'd once watched a chupacabra fight with a dog, and that during the struggle, the chupacabra managed to shave clean a patch of the off on the dog before biting it there. That both Tolentino and her husband sat there with a straight face and related these fantastic episodes to the UFO reporter should cast grave doubt upon their credibility. Today, decades after the fact, few in Puerto Rico think about, care about, or even remember the Chupacabra from 1995, especially since a long series of hurricanes have given them existent things to worry about. Existent things to worry about. When taken as a whole, the entire Chupacabra phenomenon consists of little more than three things. One, some conventional cattle mutilations, which are neither rare nor unexplained. Two, a bit of fan fiction from a couple who enjoyed the movie Species. And three, a raft of inappropriately lumped in-person, in-reports from all over of mangy dogs and coyotes or just about any strange sighting or unidentified animal. But as far as there being any evidence for an alien-like being going around and sucking the blood of livestock, you have, my friends, very good reason to be skeptical. I'm just saying. The ghosts of Candida.
It is common for locations that have played host to major military conflict to feature persistent manifestations of ghosts or other such paranormal entities. But the Japanese island of Okinawa is the site of a somewhat disproportionate number of supernatural sightings. Join us this week as we walk amongst the ghosts of Kadena Air Base. The midday sun was relentless as it beat down on the nursery's play area, much to the jubilation of its occupants, who were out enjoying the remainder of their afternoon break. But whilst the smothering heat appeared to invigorate and energize the children as they raced from one adventure to the next, it seemed to have exactly the opposite effect on the adults entrusted with their care. As she made her way around the restricted patch of asphalt, ensuring that each of the youngsters was sufficiently hydrated, Patsy Schneider was finding it ever more difficult to keep pace with her juvenile charges. Breaking into a brief jog, she managed to catch another minor, and was in the process of applying a liberal covering of sun lotion when something unexpected caught her eye. Over in the far corner of the play area, one of the children had his arm drawn back, and had apparently thrown something up and over the wooden fencing. Finishing her current task, Patsy began to thread her way through the crowded playground, observing the child again picking something up from the ground and tossing it over the fence into the yard next door. Drawing closer to the boy, she recognized him as Angelo Conti, whose father was a senior NCO attached to the 19th Tactical Electronic Warfare Squadron, which had recently deployed to the base. On closer inspection, the items at his feet were the die-cast toy cars he regularly brought to the nursery with him from home, and he proceeded to throw a further two before she managed to reach him. Patsy tactfully questioned the boy, wondering out loud if he would be sad at the end of the school day when he realized that he couldn't get his cars back. Angelo announced that he was giving them to the children who lived next door, as they didn't have any toys of their own to play with. It was a statement which immediately sent a shudder through the young teacher's body. She gently explained to Angelo that he must be mistaken, as there weren't any children next door, and that nobody had lived there for a long time. This statement was met with a warm-hearted smile from the youth, who replied that there was a little boy and a little girl next door, and that they had asked to borrow his toys. As Patsy processed what Angelo was telling her, she was startled by the shrill whistle which announced that playtime was over. Collecting his two remaining cars, the young boy dashed off to the main building, leaving his teacher staring pensively at the wooden fence paneling, which separated the playground from the small neighboring property. Explaining to one of her colleagues that she would be a minute or two late in rejoining the children, Patsy made her way next door, negotiating the wild foliage which surrounded the boarded-up building. Once she reached the point where she estimated Angelo's cars must have landed, she began to root through the long grass and weeds, hoping to recover them. She had been searching without success for several minutes, when there was a sudden and unexpected noise just behind her. The unmistakable sound of a young girl giggling immediately caused the teacher to stop in her tracks. There was a moment's silence, followed by the sound of two children whispering, only a few feet away from where she was. Patsy turned in the direction the sounds had come from, only to find the overgrown yard completely deserted. There was no place for anyone to hide, and equally, no sign of any children. But a few feet away, directly in the middle of the trail of flattened grass which marked her path across the yard, were Angelo's cars. There were seven of the toys, all arranged in a perfect circle, pointing inwards to face one another. Realizing that it was impossible for the small boy to have thrown the car so that they landed in such a fashion, and that someone or something must have arranged them whilst her back was turned, Patsy felt a sickening feeling rising up from the depths of her stomach. As she stared at the toys, she realized that the yard was now eerily silent, without even the sounds of passing traffic or birds noticeable. Ever so slowly, one of the toy cars started to rotate, until it pointed away from the center of the circle, directly towards her. With a cry of pure terror, Patsy ran screaming from the yard. Just another in a long line of people to have experienced something deeply unsettling at the airbase's most notorious building. On the morning of April 1, 1945, the United States 10th Army attacked the Japanese island of Okinawa, with the intention of using the location as a staging post to finally bring an end to the Pacific Campaign. The battle which followed would continue for 82 days, and feature some of the bloodiest and most savage fighting of the Second World War. One of the most crucial elements of the American battle plan was the seizure of the Yara Hikojo airfield, which had recently been constructed by the defenders near to the village of Kadena. By the end of the third day of fighting, the badly damaged 1,400-meter airstrip was in American hands, and work could begin on restoring it to operational use. Over the next 6 months, Kadena Air Base gradually increased in terms of size and importance to the American forces. Initially used to deploy fighter aircraft in support of further localized operations, it eventually became a key outpost, in preparation for the massive bomber campaign designed to end unyielding Japanese resistance. With the war over following the deployment of atomic weapons, the United States elected to retain the facility, which remains operational to this day. In the years which followed the end of the conflict, a steady and disconcerting number of reports were submitted to the military police in relation to inexplicable incidents which had taken place on the airbase. It soon became apparent to investigators that these issues were centered on one of the accommodation buildings, designated number 2283. It became increasingly difficult to house airmen and their families in this particular dwelling for any length of time, due to the bizarre occurrences that were allegedly taking place there. A number of families reported hearing a woman singing softly to herself around the house, only to find the rooms empty where the voice had been coming from. Sometimes, taps would be found running in the bathroom, despite there being no one inside the house. One resident even reported encountering the ghost of a young Japanese woman, washing her hair in the bath, who promptly vanished when he tried to communicate with her. But as disconcerting as these occurrences were, far more tragic events lay in store. During the 1970s, an officer who had recently been posted to the base with his family was housed in number 2283. The man's mental health quickly deteriorated, to the point where he killed his wife and children before ending his own life. This horrific incident subsequently led to an immediate increase in the number of reports of paranormal activity at the dwelling, to the extent that nobody was prepared to live there. Neighbors reported that the phone inside the house could be heard ringing at all hours of the day, only for the staff who were sent to disconnect it to discover that it had already been removed, and there was no longer even a phone inside. On a number of occasions, military police officers who were driving past the address at night noticed an unnatural glow coming from behind its drawn curtains, and were inevitably unable to locate the source of this light when they then entered. During one such encounter, a lone MP was dispatched to number 2283 one evening, following a report that bangs and clattering noises had been heard inside. Having entered the address, the soldier was shining his torch around the living room when he realized that there was someone standing next to him, who had apparently entered the room through a solid brick wall. As he spun round, the light from his torch illuminated a Japanese soldier, clad in ornate battle armor. As the samurai's hand dropped down to the sword it wore at its waist, the airman screamed out in horror and ran from the address. His colleagues were quick to make light of his account, until two other officers reported having encountered a ghostly armored warrior traversing the base. Now unable to house residents in the building, the authorities instead repurposed it for storage, but the issues stubbornly persisted. Airmen attending number 2283 to collect supplies reported the sounds of children laughing and running through the rooms. Over time, personnel housed in the surrounding accommodation claimed to have heard similar sounds emanating from the air vents in their houses. Eventually, the staff at the daycare center, which was located alongside the haunted building, formally requested that it be torn down, as it was allegedly having a negative effect on the mental health of the children in their care. A number of the youngsters told their teachers that they were friends with the children who lived in the house next door, to the extent that their parents refused to let them attend the nursery. The base commander eventually acceded to the demand, and ordered that the building be demolished so as to extend the play area of the nursery. This work would take far longer than planned, however, as the contractors who were allocated the task reported severe nausea and headaches, to the extent that they could not continue with their work. It would not be until 2009 that the cursed residence was finally destroyed, and all trace of it removed from the ground it once stood upon. Kadena is not the only location on the island to be the scene of unsettling paranormal incidents. Camp Hansen, which is situated half an hour's drive to the northeast of the airbase, was constructed during the 1960s and is home to the 12th Marine Regiment. It is built on the site of another airfield which was captured by American forces during the Battle of Okinawa, having incurred heavy losses from Japanese snipers and mortar teams. Not long after the base was completed, a sentry was on duty in the early hours of the morning at the Gate 3 guardhouse during a severe thunderstorm. As he sheltered from the driving rain in the open entrance to the guardhouse, he noticed a Marine dressed in a poncho slowly making his way up towards the gate. Stepping out into the downpour to greet the approaching soldier, he suddenly recoiled in horror. The man was dressed in a blood-soaked World War II-era uniform, with severe facial injuries. As he reached out with one blood-slicked hand towards the sentry, there was a flash of lightning, and then he was gone, leaving no trace that he had ever existed. The ghost of the unknown soldier continued to visit Marines who were allocated overnight guard duties at Gate 3. On one occasion, a terrified young sentry felt a tap on his shoulder and turned to find the bloodied Marine holding a cigarette out in front of him, asking for a light. Eventually, the base authorities decided to close down the Gate 3 guardhouse and keep the gate itself secured at all times. Banyan Tree Golf Course is located a stone's throw from Kadena Air Base and was the site of a Japanese field hospital during the war. Down by the beach there is a cave which few local residents are brave enough to enter, where the sounds of crying and wailing have been heard echoing out across the water. A number of nurses from the hospital are believed to have taken their own lives there, out of fear of the invading American forces, and the deaths of several local swimmers have been attributed to their vengeful souls. A similar phenomenon has been reported to the north at Maida Point, the site of another wartime field hospital. Over the years, spectral figures have been observed throwing themselves from the cliff tops, but vanishing in mid-air and never landing in the swirling waters below. It is believed these are also the spirits of Japanese soldiers, who elected to take their own lives in order to avoid capture. Several of these alleged spirits have been captured on film by tourists who are visiting the picturesque location. Can it be that these manifestations are somehow linked to the protracted battle which took place there nearly 80 years before? Given the proximity of these apparitions to sites which played key roles during the conflict, it is difficult to argue that there is not some form of mysterious connection between the wartime events and these modern-day hauntings. The sheer scale of suffering which took place during the invasion of Okinawa set it aside from similar battles in the campaign. Its own losses aside, the 10th Army documented over 140,000 bodies in the aftermath of the operation, of which nearly a third were civilians. Controversy still rages over the number of these victims who were either forcibly deployed against the American forces or executed by the Japanese army for refusing to fight. Is it possible that some powerful force was generated as a result of such a large scale and tragic loss of life, and that it somehow prevents the souls of the departed from leaving the field of battle? Or are the individuals who refuse to move on to the afterlife unable to do so out of confusion or even anger? The fact that so many of the witnesses to these incidents are service personnel acts as something of a double-edged sword in terms of their plausibility. On one hand, the stigma and ridicule attached to a professional witness claiming to have encountered a ghost makes it hard to understand why any soldier would make up such a story. On the other, members of the armed forces have something of a propensity to embellish mundane encounters, which then become ever more fantastic with each successive retelling. A certain percentage of these occurrences can be attributed to the mental stresses and strains which naturally accompany the undertaking of military duties so far from home. But the sheer volume and similarity of the Okinawan encounters does seem to indicate that something very much out of the ordinary is occurring there. As always, it is our sincerest hope that whatever force seemingly compels the souls of the wartime dead to remain on this earth eventually frees them and allows them to move on to a place of peace.
Sorry, I like those end credits. Our friends over at Bedtime Stories, thank you very much. Children find it more difficult than adults to recognize people wearing face masks, and it could affect their ability to make friends, a study finds from the dailymail.com, UK, Dateline, February 7th, 2022. But we've known this. We've known this for a while, have we not? While face masks were once rare sightings amid COVID-19 pandemic, they become everyday items for many people. Despite their popularity, a new study has revealed that face masks could be making it more difficult for children to recognize faces. Can you imagine the kids in these formative early years not visually seeing expressions? All these poor kids are going to, do I dare say, delayed. And in turn could affect their ability to make friends. Researchers from York University found that face masks make it 20% more difficult for children to recognize faces compared to just 15% of adults. Hell, it's probably greater for me, and I'm an adult. This could impair children's ability to navigate through social interactions with their peers and teachers, and this could lend to issues forming important relationships, said Erez Freud, who led the study. Again, a lot can be said by nonverbal comments. Given the importance of faces to social interactions, this is something we need to pay attention to. You think? While previous research has found that mask wearing can hinder facial recognition in adults, this is the first time it has been studied in children. Dr. Freud, no relation, explained, faces are among the most important visual stimuli. We use facial information to determine different attributes about a person, including their gender, age, mood, and intentions. We use this information to navigate through social interactions. The team recruited 72 children aged 6 to 14 who were presented with images of faces with or without masks, both upright and inverted. The results showed that children had about a 20% impairment rate for recognizing mask faces. For comparison, previous research has shown that adults have about a 50% impairment rate. So long story short, what does this mean? Well, it means that children have a difficult time recognizing individuals with masks on. Children process faces differently when looking at masks and on masks and masked individuals. The only upside of it, I guess, is that the researchers found that when children looked at masked faces, they became more analytical, focusing on individual features. Okay, eyes, I presume, eyebrows. But again, unintended consequences, kiddies, unintended consequences of what happens when you don't think before you act. Right, folks, 90 seconds of George Thorogood. 90 seconds of George Thorogood.
To be by myself.
woke from a terrible dream. Whoa, 90 seconds. That's it. That's all you can do. That's all you can do. 90 seconds of a song. But I think you're able to, for a few seconds, not play it. And then, no security, Mario, no connection to the people. What do you mean by that, Pat? I think after 90 seconds, then you can pot it back up. 94 seconds. Okay, 70 seconds. Okay, that was 70 seconds, I think. Oh, I thought it was 90. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm done. No, it's over. What did you mean, Pac, by no security, Mario, no connection to the people? About the face masks with kids? That's the only complaint I have is the 30-second delay. I was timing it. I was shorting myself, as they say. I was shorting myself. Last record I listened to was George Thorogood live in a friend's garage on a stereo I gifted him. Look at. I am not what you would define as a music buff. People say, Mario, what kind of music do you like? I simply say, whatever I'm in the mood for. I mean, there are road tripping songs, as they say. There are songs that are just kind of good for cleaning. There are genres of music that you play on in the background when you're just dinking around in the garage. Yes, Pac, yes. Children, when you view some, look at last relationship I had, still refer to this young man as, he's not a young man anymore, as my favorite little guy. Known him since he was age 4. And I dated his mother for 6 years, so up through age 10. And he always had the best facial expressions, but he always knew just by the look on her face if we were confused, concerned. We never got angry. There's maybe a little disappointment, but kids know what that face looks like. It's like when you're a mother or a parent, maybe a mother more so. She knows when the cry is the child's in pain or the child's upset because they didn't get a chocolate bar or, you know, there are different tones of crying. So, yes. I mean, heck, I walk down the hall and I see people with face masks and I at work and I got no clue who these people are. They go, hey, Mario. I'm like, hi. Because I don't recognize them. And I'm an adult. Now, in my defense, it's normally in the morning when I'm hopping into work. So I have my coat on, my face mask, and my hat because today's temperature was, you know, 7. But yeah, no, I understand. It is not good, as they say. But, you know, what are you gonna do? I don't know. It's just, it's sad. Yeah, what are you gonna do? It's sad. It's not good. It's not, I'm not saying it's bad, but it ain't good. It ain't good, as they say. And as always, to make myself feel better, this week's edition of Thomas Sowell.
This whole notion that this is the black family has always been disintegrating, that is nonsense. That his studies go up to 1925, the great bulk of black families were intact, two-parent families up through 1925, and going all the way back through the era of slavery. So it is now only within our own time that we suddenly see this inevitable tragedy which the welfare system says it's going to rush in to solve.
It's been 40 years since the show aired. and Thomas Sowell's writings continue to illuminate. Whether the topic is race, crime, immigration, or so many other subjects, his scholarship remains as relevant as ever.
Racists may prefer one race to another, but they prefer themselves to everybody else.
Thomas Sowell is a trained economist. He's a sociologist who has written books about virtually every culture that's ever existed. He is a photographer. He is America's greatest contemporary living philosopher.
I'm Jason Riley. I'm a journalist and author. For more than two decades, I have closely studied the life and work of Thomas Sowell. His story is both fascinating and illuminating.
Tom makes a very, very good point that general principles affect everybody, whether they're black, brown, or purple.
Tom is fearless not just in advancing unpopular opinions, but in venturing into areas of scholarship that have been untrodden.
Tom Sowell is known for his views on economics, history, race, and politics. But I've also discovered some lesser-known aspects of his life. His research and his writings about late-talking children, and the fact that he is a highly regarded world-traveling photographer.
Over the next hour, we'll examine the life and career of Dr. Thomas Sowell.
How he rose from humble beginnings to attend and teach at some of the nation's leading institutions and became one of our foremost social commentators.
You were a Marxist at one time in your life. What was your wake-up to what was wrong with that line of thinking?
Facts. You're about to meet one of the greatest minds of the past half century.
Funding for this program has been provided by L.E. Phillips Family Foundation, Robert and Marion Oster, the Lyndon and Harry Bradley Foundation, Incorporated, DKT Liberty Project, the Charles and Ann John.
Luther King Jr. said it best, viewing Tom, and hundreds more selecting stories he's told over the years to others to help us understand what makes Thomas Sowell unique.
Sowell's body of work is quite vast. It's covered everything from economics and history to culture, migration, and racial inequality.
The main thing that he's done, in my opinion, is to cause people to rethink their assumptions about all sorts of things, not just economics, but about race, about politics, about how we get along.
Tom is absolutely fearless. I mean, he's forceful in his opinions. He will not compromise any of his opinions for the sake of social politeness.
How do you take the measure of a man, especially if he's someone who's impacted our thinking about politics and economics for more than half a century? Do you do it through his deeds or influence? Or by what he says or writes? Perhaps Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said it best. The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy.
The media, the television, and the print media, they've wised up. You can't argue with Tom, so you might as well hide what he's doing. And that's what they're doing. They're just ignoring what he's written because there's no way that they can argue with Tom Sowell.
What distinguishes Thomas Sowell's scholarship? First, intellectual honesty, asking the right questions, gathering the relevant data, and following the facts to their logical conclusion, even if that conclusion turns out to be unpopular. Second, the importance of incentives and the reality of trade-offs in addressing our social problems. Third, the belief that a group's upward mobility derives primarily from its development of human capital. And finally, Sowell has an abiding respect for social processes and existing institutions and the role they play in decision-making.
So where did Tom Sowell's ideas come from? What formed the foundation of a man who would go on to become one of the country's foremost public intellectuals? That story began 600 miles to the south of Midtown Manhattan, more than eight decades ago.
Thomas Sowell was born in Gastonia, North Carolina, on June 30, 1930. The Great Depression was just getting underway. And like many blacks in the South at the time, His family had no electricity, no central heating, and no hot running water. Sol's father died before Tom was born. And his mother, a maid, died in childbirth just a few years later.
He was adopted by his great aunt and raised by her and her two daughters. So he had, was raised by three women.
My whole career would not have been possible without the particular family in which I was raised, which was not composed of educated people. I mean, nobody in that family had ever graduated from high school, and most had not graduated from grade school. But they were interested in education, and they were interested in me.
Tom was raised by a great aunt and her adult children. The family moved to New York City's Harlem neighborhood, a migration that exposed him to better schools and more opportunities than were available to blacks in the segregated South.
My great fear is that a black child growing up in Harlem today will not have as good a chance to rise as people of my generation did, simply because they will not receive as solid an education in an era when such an education is even more important.
When Thomas Sowell was 8 years old, his family moved from North Carolina to New York City and settled here at 720 St. Nicholas Avenue in the neighborhood of Harlem. The building looks pretty much the same as it did more than 80 years ago when the Sowells moved in. Young Tommy, as he was called, ventured out into a big city for the very first time. He rode double-decker buses.
We'll have to finish this next week, kids. There's the top of the hour music. Have yourself a fabulous Monday. In the words of Katie Couric, good night, y'all.
Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomsteps.com, the People Station.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.